Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Like, your medical insurance? Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha. Yeah, I'm not the one that's gonna fucking need it.
Okay. Sure.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 504 for the week of March 25th, 2024. I am Rough Seas Shave David T. Cole, and I'm here with Extreme Irritation Sarah D. Bunting.
Beats working.
Thick-thighed hitchhiker Tara Ariano.
Hurry and pick me up before I take all my clothes off again.
And American Crocodile Taylor Cole.
I hide my food. Did you know that? I hide my food.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, he is the host of the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. And if you knew it was good for you, you just heard him with past and future guests Carrie Race and Nick Reinwald Jones running the Leonard Maltin game for all our Patreon supporters a couple weekends ago. It's Taylor Eskold!
Taylor!
Hello! Great to be back.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about Roadhouse, parentheses, 2024, in which, when her uncle died, Frankie, Jessica Williams, inherited his roadhouse called The Roadhouse in the Florida Keys. But she's been having a lot of problems with rowdies roughhousing, so she follows a tip on the best underground fighter, only to see him immediately flee the ring when he sees his next opponent is Dalton, Jake Gyllenhaal. Frankie offers Dalton $5,000 a week to come be her head bouncer, and after his car/home becomes unusable, Dalton accepts. But when he gets to Glass Key, he finds out that Frankie's problems are more complicated than she let on. The movie is based on the flawless 1989 feature film Roadhouse, starring Patrick Swayze. This one is directed by Doug Liman. We'll talk about it. It dropped on Prime Video last week. We may spoil any part of it. Let's do the Chen check-in. Taylor, should our listeners watch Roadhouse 2024?
You can skip it.
Sarah?
Surely not. whatever you want to do.
Twist.
I mean, it's always whatever you want to do. But yes.
What if we could make this law somehow?
Yes.
We'd probably have more subscribers. You know how Netflix specializes in the movie genre of A-list actor in serviceable but forgettable endeavor?
Yes.
This is that, but on Amazon.
Yep.
So your skippability will fall in line exactly with movies like Extraction and Triple Frontier and all the things like that. So I think you can gauge this one for yourself based on that metric.
I agree with Dave. I would have liked it more if it had zero connection to the original movie and it was just generic action movie 79.
There are things about the original that will remain in my head until the day I pass from Earth.
Yes.
There are things about this movie that will leave my brain forever by the time this segment is done. Like, it's already falling out of my head, this whole thing. It's because it's one of those Netflix.
Yes, it is.
B minus C plus movies.
Yep, completely. All right, let's get into the spoiler zone. One of the great movie experiences of my life was realizing probably about 20 years after it came out that Dave and I had never seen the first Roadhouse. We started it at like 1 a.m. on a Saturday night. I tweeted it. Had a great time. Taylor, what is your relationship to Rowdy Harrington's Roadhouse?
It's a movie I saw for the first time probably 5 years ago. So similarly, a good deal after it had come out. And I also had a darn good time with it. It was, a good movie to just kind of throw on with a friend on a Friday afternoon after we were both home from work early. And just kind of had this moment of it kind of falls into that perfect blend of this is very silly and over the top and ridiculous, but there is also like a deeply human soulfulness and like Zen wisdom to that movie that I like had to actually take seriously and reckon with and sort of loved it for that. But also, you know, he's ripping guys' throats right out of his neck. It's kind of the whole package.
He sure is.
It's like you went to church and instead of wafers, they're giving you cocaine.
Yeah.
Yes. But it is a movie that was on Prime at the time, and before it had finished playing, I had already ordered it on physical media. So it was an immediate like, oh, I want to have this like to watch whenever I want, forever. So
yeah,
definitely a lot of appreciation for it over here.
Sarah, same question.
Well, Sam Elliott is in it, so I probably don't need to continue. But in the event that I do,
yeah,
I'm very fond of Roadhouse, even though it just sort of flawed in its inception. But that's the beauty of it. Like, that flaw created a pearl, I guess, which they sort of put into the dialogue explicitly in this version. Very dumb. But I also lived with people, namely my brother and his wife, for a while who owned it in like multiple media and would have like roadie horror nights where people would just be like hanging out in their living room, reciting the entire movie and eating snacks. And that is living right. Credit to Dave Jr. for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, love the original and like didn't hate this one, but its reasons for it, like my saying, why does this exist? It all sort of applies to the original as well. So
sure. Once the story came out about the original writer suing Amazon, claiming that it used AI to replicate actors' voices in order to beat the copyright expiration date during the strikes, it was like, oh, okay, that's why it exists. Like, someone wants to hang on to this Dick Tracy zooms in stuff.
Yes.
Just more like a little more elaborate about it. Before we get into the particulars of this version of the movie, Taylor, you're famously a movie buff. We've already heard about your physical media addiction. Do you have any kind of grand unified theory about movie remakes, like what makes a title a good or bad candidate to be remade, for example?
I generally tend to side with the great Chicago critic Scott Tobias, who often goes online to shout, remake bad movies, don't remake good movies.
Ocean's 11, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if there are movies with an interesting, fun premise but are not well executed, that's the perfect fodder for remaking something. Mm. And as a result, like, Roadhouse is still, for what it is, like, well executed for what it's trying to accomplish. And thus, it didn't seem like Roadhouse was a movie that was begging to be remade for me. So I wasn't I wasn't clamoring for this.
Yeah. But you're here, so we got to talk about it.
Yes, no, I've got plenty to say.
So we'll link this in the show notes as well. Dave Chen of the Chen Check-In reviewed this at his newsletter, Decoding Everything. He said part of what makes this an awkward watch is that it doesn't feel like it has a consistent tone. I would agree. Taylor, what did you think?
Yeah, it's for me, it most interestingly fits into the Doug Liman kind of filmography that you had mentioned. And that one of the things I've liked very many Doug Liman movies over the years. I have not seen all of them, but the ones that work the best for me are the ones that really kind of blend his, you know, he came up during the 90s independent cinema boom where he's doing things that feel very just like we're just running out onto the street and filming something handheld, but all somehow making that genuinely cinematic. Like, it doesn't feel like, you know, some mumblecore shit. It actually feels like you've got some money and real excitement behind it. I think that's, you know, there's a lot of that in Swingers. There's certainly a ton of that in The Bourne Identity, and particularly in American Made, which I think is a super underrated Doug Liman movie from 2017. And there's a lot of that in Roadhouse, which I think is was some of the moments where I did like it the best. You know, the fact that it does feel very just sort of, you know, kind of person with a camera in this environment, letting some of the takes run a little bit longer for these fight sequences while still feeling, you know, this kind of blend of hi-fi and lo-fi at the same time. The biggest problem for me is that the visual effects in this thing are unnecessary and a major, major distraction. Mm-hmm. Like, anytime there is, you know, it's, oh, you don't have to cut on a punch, which is one of the things that, you know, some of the filmmakers are saying, like, we have this new technology where we're like subbing in CGI body doubles seamlessly so that we're, you know, can really see every single hit and we can see the really bad, you know, CGI blood and spit that's flying off of everything. And it just, in your attempt to do something that's a little bit more technically accomplished, just whatever money you had was not there enough to make it look good. And it completely, every fight sequence completely takes me out of the movie in that regard.
Yeah. Sarah, what did you think of the tone and the effect?
I thought the tone was kind of all over the place, but this might be a casting issue also. And I don't mean issue in the sense that it's a problem, but like Patrick Swayze, we miss him, had a real gift for taking these extremely outlandishly self-serious characters and settings, like his character in Dirty Dancing, Kin, if anyone ever sat through that nonsense, the original Roadhouse, The Outsiders. Like, he really had a way of centering these characters that had absolutely no business taking their own shit as seriously as they did. So to have that speed or not speed, Point Break is another example.
Yeah.
That Bodhi, like on paper, you hear that dialogue and you're like, massive jerk off motion with both arms. But then he kind of puts it over because he just had a gift for that. And that was also pinned to a time when a lot of cocaine fueled pitches were getting made into features. Let's face it.
I have a question about that. If you're massive jerk off motion with both arms, are you jerking off two things at once, or is it like a giant dick that you're sort of that's on your stomach and you're like cradling it up and down?
Either way.
First one, then the other. Got it.
I mean, I really felt like Dave's arm gesture was not expansive enough. I was going like tree trunk with anyway.
I got two guys to jerk off and they don't like each other.
Exactly.
It's like feeding our dogs.
Welcome
right now.
To Four Corners. Yeah. Drive safely. But the casting of Jake Gyllenhaal, which like I thought Gyllenhaal was really good in this role, but he has a much more sort of like jokey, let's put on a show. You think we need one more? Like Ocean's 11 vibe, mm-hmm. actually, the remake, that it's like he was unexpectedly good and suited to this, but that's not the Swayze vibe. And I think in this story, you need an actor who's not going to be quite so like self-aware as to how bonkers it is that this bar owner wouldn't just let herself be bought out or hire legit security or torch the place herself and collect some insurance money or anything that doesn't involve paying Jake Gyllenhaal $5,000 a week and her band is behind a chain link fence and like they will keep playing even when the place is completely emptied out and you're like, this is insane. Gyllenhaal's character seems to realize that in a way that a lot of the other characters don't. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my tone problem with it, was that the casting of the original versus this one and the main bouncer, you know, fucking bouncer guy character, I don't think Gyllenhaal's vibe quite goes with the seriousness with which Roadhouse overall takes itself and should not. So... Yeah. But, I mean, he was very watchable. Also, Billy Magnussen, what the hell?
Yeah, well, let's get to him in a second. Dave, you liked Gyllenhaal. That was the first thing you said at the end, so go ahead.
Yeah, I did. I was sort of like, this is going to fall out of my head pretty quick, but I did like his performance. There are times when he just performs with one of his eyes. Like, there are scenes where just one of his eyes is bigger than the other, and you're like, oh, okay, I understand what's going on here, which I don't think anybody has done since Marty Feldman.
Or Prisoners, when Jake Gyllenhaal's character has a glass eye, and every one of his performances since Prisoners has had different eyes doing different things thing.
You got something in your toolkit. Use it.
Exactly.
Coming next Christmas, the road overs. Yes, go on.
Yes, exactly.
My problem is that it is such a fundamental miscalculation to go from Zen cowboy as your central character to suicidal ultimate fighting champion, but I forget what the league is called.
Yeah.
Ultimate fighting guy.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they do that? Why would they make that the anchor of everything?
Like, yeah.
Especially with everything else that's going on, the crazy millionaire son trying to get a shave on the boat and all this sort of stuff. And then there's like your lead character sad because he killed or almost killed somebody in the ring because he's a rageaholic or was a rageaholic or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like that seemed like the backstory to get to the point why he is now a Zen cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't go that far. This is like, well, we'll save that for the sequel. Like there was, they didn't go far enough with where that character was going to get to the Swayze destination. Yeah. It was just like the worst decision they made for this.
Absolutely. Man pain, no offense, men, is always going to be a tough sell for me. Like you have to handle it very well. I mean, I just mentioned the holdovers. That's a good example of like doing it right. That man pain is not what this story needs, unless you mean physical pain because a guy you just met 5 minutes ago broke your wrist for you.
The only man pain you need in Roadhouse is when Sam Elliott dies.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
And they didn't even have that character.
No,
in this
they
one.
Didn't.
The note I took on Swayze versus Gyllenhaal was that, like, Swayze is somehow, like, the most human character in the movie. Like, he's more deeply felt than everyone else. And Gyllenhaal is somehow, like, an extraterrestrial. He's the least human character in the movie. He's, like, he's playing it as though he's been, like, sent from another planet to study human behavior and then just, like, got in too deep with the UFC stuff. Like, that's sort of the backstory I have ascribed to him. Because there is, both of them have this distance from the other characters around him, this inscrutability. And I think it works for Gyllenhaal, but it's framed in such a different way.
Yeah. We already brought up Billy Madison. No, we already brought up Billy Magnuson.
Every one of us is now doing
today, Tara.
As Big Bad Junior. And that was another thing that made me think this was a setup for a sequel, because like there's sure been a lot of talk about his dad who's in prison. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess we're going to find out who that is in the next one or whatever. But he had a real Livewire energy that I thought was fun. It took so long to introduce him. Sarah, I know you love him too. Go ahead. Go off on Billy Magnuson.
Magnuson.
I'm just making sure I said it right.
Yeah, I love him, and I've seen him play big bads before in a much less cartoonish and more sort of slowly the hackles rise way. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's good at anything. He could have been the alligator, would have been awesome.
Yes,
but it did sort of seem like this is a lot of acting weapon for a literal fight that is not about that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, oh God, like you have him and you have Conor McGregor like nuding around in his socks and nothing else. Like this, I think that Dave Chen was right in his review that this movie couldn't decide if it took this situation extremely seriously or not seriously at all. And sometimes that changed during a fight scene. Yeah. And you're like, when he's like wakes up on the roof where he has been ejected, I'm going to say 250 yards from a crashed boat. Mm-hmm. And you're like, is this Rocky and Bullwinkle? Yeah. Is this The Matrix? Like, how do I feel? Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt nothing, which was fine. On the whole, the performances were better than they needed to be from performers that were better than this project demanded. Mm-hmm. But I was okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of the same problem as Gladiator, which we recently rewatched over the holidays, where it's like there's all these absolutely batshit crazy fights, and then it all builds to the climax of Russell Crowe versus this like fucking wiener who's already sabotaged him before the fight even starts, Joaquin Phoenix. And it's, you know, Conor McGregor, they're more evenly matched, but at the same time, it's like it feels like the stakes are sort of like stair-stepping down through all of the different fight scenes we see. Speaking of people that were underused, Dave said he would have rather seen the love interest be Jessica Williams. And I have to agree, because the love interest.
I had this note as well. Yes.
She was, I mean, I just have her in my notes as the lady. Like, what was her name? Ellie? Who cares? Like, she was so bad and forgettable. But anyway, Dave, go off on Jessica Williams, and then Tyler, you can. Taylor, sorry.
I don't know what to add to that. Just to say that, you know, the nurse was a charisma vacuum. Yeah. I didn't believe that you would fall in love with her or that she could heal me.
Taylor, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, part of this stems from the fact that as I watch this and compare it to the original, it really feels like they were just flipping a coin with every decision they could have made about what do we keep the same as the original and what do we change? Like, every change felt arbitrary. But by having the club owner be Jessica Williams, and they immediately, I think their first scene together, Gyllenhaal and Williams have pretty good chemistry. I didn't think they were going to have the nurse character at all. I thought they said, oh, this is going to combine this and streamline this. And then, when the nurse character shows up, it's just, what's the point?
To be fair to this bad, boring character I didn't like, I think she's a doctor, not a nurse.
Oh, excuse me.
She's a lady?
She is a lady.
Doctor Lady Bad Boring?
Yes.
I mean, she reminded me of another wonderful South Florida set movie full of himbos, Magic Mike, and that she was like the Cody Horn character who every time she's on scene, you're like, get out of here. See more wieners or in the space fighting. Lucas Gage shows up, does not have a very graphic sex scene with any man. Like, what the fuck are you even here for? I mean, I thought for sure when he got beat up, it's like, oh, this guy's going to die. And that's going to be like inflaming someone. But no, instead, it was the wise child and her used bookstore owning dad who like no one wanted this either.
No, like, no.
No. So extraneous.
The used bookstore owner and Pomeranian caregiver was like, look, movie, I'm already here. Calm down. You have my membership dollars. Mm. Take it easy.
Did anyone but me notice at the very end of the list of stunt performers, one Casper Van Dien? Because he was.
Wow.
Yeah. What?
That's, yeah. Well, he's got to get paid somehow, I guess.
He's from Buenos Aires. He says... Fight them all.
Stunt them all.
Yeah. Taylor, you brought this up in your intro. Crocodiles v. alligators. Do you have a type five on this?
Like, which one is scarier or just what is the difference between them?
No, do you have a comedy routine about alligators? Yes. Alligators walk like this.
I did legitimately have, when they said crocodile, like, I didn't think crocodiles were in Florida.
I didn't
either. I had to look it up. There are American crocodiles that are only in the Florida Keys. Once you get farther north into the Everglades.
That's my favorite Lyman film, American Crocodile.
American Crocodile. And that's the point. That's a thing that absolutely could have been sillier and more ridiculous. But it's again, it's the tone. That's a moment where it doesn't know whether or not this is deathly scary or the goofiest thing in the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that crocodile killed three more people throughout the movie, that would have been great.
Yeah. Yes!
Or three more Pomeranians. Just have the harbor master, like, occasionally he's like, it's Chauncey too, and Chauncey has a little top hat and a little vest on, and then Chauncey's gone, and this guy is getting increasingly upset and sobbing. I mean, no offense, Pomeranians.
Or instead of Conor McGregor snapping Billy Magnuson's neck, it's like, oh, what's that? If right in that moment when Magnuson's sort of entering the final fray, that's when the crocodile needs to come back and take out Billy Magnuson. That's when the movie becomes fun.
Mm-hmm.
My one final thought, because I did think Jake Gyllenhaal was fine, but it's hard not to know that he's like kind of a bad person off screen. I mean, one of the lead candidates for yelled at Rebecca Ferguson on a set of a movie that she was in, just saying. But I did spend quite a bit of time fantasy casting other people that could have been in it. Channing Tatum was on my list, possibly because of the Magic Mike parallels. And then because of the Doug Liman connection, fucking Emily Blunt. Let's see a Lady Dalton.
Yeah.
Well, this movie first entered like development over a decade ago, and for a while it was going to be Ronda Rousey in a remake of Roadhouse, which is probably how the UFC subplot even got in there in the first place.
Right.
But then, you know, through probably half a dozen different directors and stars, it finally arrived at this thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was, as we said, fine and a shrug.
I would have recast the polar bear as the lead.
Yes.
As Dalton.
Of course.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right. Time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
We watched Girls 5 Ever last week. Season 3 is finally here on Netflix. The first two seasons are as well. So if you never watched the show because you didn't have Peacock, now you can. Season 2 ended with the band getting dropped by their label and going on a self-financed tour. Also, right after Dawn, Sarah Bareilles found out she was pregnant, so that's a lot of story track for them to ride on. The show, obviously, is very heightened, but they also do their research on the realities of the contemporary music industry, like how it could really fuck you as an indie artist if you stand up to one club owner who then ends up owning every other club you were planning to play in the region, which is what happens in the second episode with John Early guest starring as a psychotic Texas politician with his wife, Motor, the old English word for mother. Or how if you want to make a lot of money fast, a great way is to sell out and play a billionaire trophy wife's birthday party in Orlando, that one guest starred Catherine Cohen, or how hellish life might be even if you were an extremely successful touring musician like Gray Holland, played by Thomas Malone from the Gossip Girl reboot and his cheekbones, in a storyline that was apparently inspired by Grimes, who ate spaghetti for an entire couple of years while she was on tour and had to go to the doctor, according to Meredith Sardino. Probably my favorite episode of the season involves Wiki, who's played by Renee Elise Goldsberry. Over the years, and particularly in this season, as she makes their driver, Percy, John Lutz, wonderful. None of your lumps line up. Shoot her for a tour documentary. She's talked about her hardscrabble youth, and the third episode brings us to Maryland and introduces us to her parents in a very satisfying payoff for all of those gags, which turn out to have had more cohesion than we thought. The first two seasons had 8 episodes. This one had 6, I assume, for budgetary reasons, which was kind of a bummer to me at first. But in terms of the season arc, it does feel satisfying just because every episode is absolutely fucking packed with jokes. When you are taking notes for writing / podcasting purposes, it is so hard to keep up. So I'm glad I got to watch the very short season again last week with Dave. It's good. Watch it so they make more. I won't mind 6 episode seasons if we, you know, get one every year until no one wants to do it anymore. Dave, did you have anything to add about the season?
We watched it far enough in the past, thanks to your screener privilege, that I don't remember too much about the particulars of it. But yeah, I did enjoy it. The show is still good.
All right. For my plugs, I did interview Meredith Scardino. We'll link that in the show notes. And I also reviewed the new Kristen Wiig, Carol Burnett, Allison Janney, Apple TV Plus series, Palm Royale, which you might think that cast means it's a good show. And then you hear the Apple TV Plus part and you're like, oh, never mind. Because they haven't done a good comedy since Dickinson. I'm not going to fight about it. I'm just saying that's a fact. So you can read both of those. Links are in the show notes.
All right, Taylor, what have you been watching lately?
I have been rewatching Lost, and I gotta say, I am loving my rewatch of Lost. It's a show I kind of thought I would never actually go back and rewatch, largely because of Extra Hot Great. Back in Mark 1, you did a canon episode on a season 1 episode, and listening to that canon presentation and hearing it takes on, it's like, oh, well, if you kind of, there is no mystery left, or you know the mysteries aren't going to be solved, why would you ever go back to the show? And that was kind of my read on it for several years. But for some reason, an itch just happened a few months ago and have now been going through my second time through, but watching with someone who it is their first time through. And I got to say, when you're unmoored from the potential for disappointment by the ending, I found the ending emotionally satisfying the first time. But knowing that, like, not everything is going to fall into place and you can just sort of admire the ambition and the ride of it, I am having the absolute best time without that weight of expectation. So a hard recommend for a rewatch of Lost in this day and age. It's truly, truly a good time. And for all of the, you know, things that we were disappointed that were kind of set up but never really amounted to anything, it distracts from the fact that there's so much stuff that was set up so early on that did amount to stuff later on in ways that was satisfying midstream. So being able to sort of reverse engineer some of that, but also have storylines that I had 100% completely forgotten about be these nice memory moments and nuggets that they go. It's just been a really, really great time. So a hard recommend for rewatching Lost in this year, 2024. The patience of this is it's an incredibly patient show in ways that I like admired about Better Call Saul in terms of how it really had to slow things down. Obviously, different aims, different end games for those two shows, but really sort of having that same calming zen slow paced style that has been great. A side recommendation for that, I have been, as I've been watching, listening to a podcast called The Storm from about 5 years ago. The hosts of the Game of Thrones podcast, Storm of Spoilers, Joanna Robinson, Dave Gonzalez, Neil Miller, between that podcast and now their Trial by Content podcast, for like 2 years, did a full Lost rewatch week by week podcast. And that has been a fantastic companion. So if you watch along, definitely listen to that as well. And I only recently discovered their theme music is by DJ Empirical, member of the Extra Hot Great Discord community, editor of the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. So their theme music rules. Even if you don't watch Lost, listen to one episode so you can hear his great music. For my plugs, the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show, previously mentioned, and we recently announced it is coming to an end. We got 4 more episodes coming at you through April and May. So please jump aboard and hear our big send-off finale. It should be a lot of fun. But also, the G&T podcast that has been on intermittent hiatuses over the last couple of years has been back with a vengeance. We are releasing episodes with much more regularity, talking double features that hopefully pair as well as Gin and Tonic. But our names are Greta and Taylor, so that's why it's called G&T. We recently did an episode on 2 movies starring Jack Black, 2 Miyazaki movies, and we just did a big 2023 movie year in review roundup, which was a super highlight. So check that out. And if you want to subscribe to the This Had Oscar Buzz Patreon, you can hear me singing about Annette Bening on their Oscars recap episode. So thank check God. That out as well.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Homicide, colon, New York. Not to be confused with Homicide, colon, Life on the Street, or New York Undercover, or New York Homicide. This one is the Dick Wolf unscripted series. We mentioned it in previous episodes last week or the week before. It is new to Netflix. It's not bad. but it's the kind of not bad it is that it's just not necessary to your lives. It's a true crime show that you can probably, you know, figure out the contents from the tin. My esteemed colleague Eve Beatty and I talked about this on The Docket over at Best Evidence last week. That's our mini podcast that we do once a week. Our guest was Andy Dennert. He also reviewed it and despised it. Eve and I were more like hashtag sigh. But here's the thing with this particular flavor of nonfiction copaganda. You need to do that thing, the literal, these are their stories, cops remembering part, and just do it well and not try to have it both ways by performatively centering victims and survivors, but then having their parts of any given episode be draggy and boring. The parts with the retired detectives have a much more flavorful way of speaking. They have much more interesting things to say about process. The editing is more attentive in those sections. But then at the same time, there's one guy who got taken off a case in the premiere episode because Bernard Carrick, of all people, got a bee up his dupa about the detective showing up to a crime scene, not in a suit and tie, and then getting into it with Carrick's office's photographer. But there's no context or pushback on Carrick himself or any of that. Like, Rudy Giuliani might as well not even have gone to this school. According to an episode that was happy to use 9/11 to make the cops who are on camera more sympathetic, which is like, just be the thing that you are, even if it's not, quote, popular. I mean, what is the point of this then? I don't think it actually is always the worst thing to make the police your narrators. I don't think it's impossible to make their version the dominant one in a true crime show with, and then not heroize them unduly. But you have to commit to that framework. I think the main problem might be that Wolf comes from scripted shows. He is used to now the rhythms of a network hour and act breaks. And as a result, the pacing can seem hesitant and slow. Wolf's scripted stuff wants to perfect the world instead of reflecting it. That's not the brief for a docuseries. I liked Crime and Punishment fine, but that was 2002 when you could just like throw a bunch of footage up, not color correct anything, and have it seem verite and new. You can't get by with that now, but you can't really get by with this either. Doesn't matter. He's got a however many series deal. They're doing the Los Angeles version later this year. I'm probably not going to recommend that either because they're totally going to be like, what's a rampart? But I watch these things so you don't have to. That is the point of Best Evidence. This is not offensively bad, but you absolutely don't need it. Watch something else. Speaking of things you can watch that we do recommend, bestevidence.fyi is the place where we tell you the true crime that's worth your time. We've actually been finding a fair bit lately that is worth your time. This isn't, but you could find all of that at bestevidence.fyi, like I said.
I'm here with a recommendation. We watched the whole run of the show we made a little bit of hay of on Extra Extra Hot Great recently, which is Chicken Nugget. Mm-hmm. There's a TV show called Chicken Nugget. It comes from Korea, and it is about, if you translate the poster, it is about a woman who gets turned into a chicken nugget. And that's true. Right. That mm-hmm. is, I say, the gist of the story. There is a lady. She's in a sort of gadget company's premises, and she walks into what looks like a fancy closet, and she gets turned into a chicken nugget. And that is like not the weirdest thing that happens in this series. And I don't really want to explain too much more because like it is a very creative, fun journey. It is a lot of wackiness. There's a lot of heart in this show. We kind of watched it as a dare to ourselves just because it sounded so dumb. And I got to say, it's one of my favorite shows I've watched this year so far. It was super fun. Wow. The leads are great. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good Netflix stuff coming out of Korea. Like they're doing a good job bringing the good stuff over here at any rate. Mm-hmm. A little sci-fi. It's a little adventure. There's a little mystery show in it, but not too much. You know, it's not like a Reddit mystery show. If you're in the mood for something that covers a lot of bases as far as your TV diet goes, this is a good show to recommend. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Tara, but you watched it. Did you enjoy it as well?
I did. Probably my favorite single episode is the one where we reunite with one of the leads, exes, who is a food blogger, and we find out all of the food differences they had during their relationship that ended up breaking them up, which are two out of three that were mentioned were ones that have come up in our household. So that was very amusing to me. Yeah, it was really funny. And like Dave said, unexpected. Like, we just were looking for something to watch one night. It was like, do you want to watch one of these and see if it's any good? And by, you know, halfway through, we were both delighted. So I was posting a little bit about it on Blue Sky, and people were telling me, if you're interested in weird Korean comedies, this is a rich vein for you. So if this is your area, if you watch Chicken Nugget, get at us on the Discord and tell us what we should watch next. Because I'm definitely interested in, like, more shows in this I won't say chicken vein, but yes, in this realm.
All right. Coming up on this week's Extra, Extra Hot, Great. It is Lifetime's acting coach nightmare. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to this. We were talking about what was like available to, what would the lead topics be? And we're like, this show and this show that's starting on this channel. And then this was thrown up. It's got to be that one. It's got to be something called Acting Coach Nightmare.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to be the most fun to talk about. So members can listen to that this Friday. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join if you're not yet a member. And come back here next week on EHG Prime for AMC's Parish. And we welcome back Omar Gallego for that one. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Taylor S. Cole. Take it away, Taylor.
Hello, hosts of Extra Hot Floor. Y'all need to get on program because it's time for the canon. Like many people, I have a lifelong attachment to George Lucas's Star Wars. I loved the OT as a small child and was young/naive enough to enjoy the 1997 special editions in theaters. I admittedly loved The Phantom Menace as a 9-year-old, but my decreasingly rapturous responses to Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith are perhaps the best indicator of my descent into teenage cynicism. Nonetheless, I was there at midnight in 2015 to see The Force Awakens, was over the moon for The Last Jedi, and prefer to forget about The Rise of Skywalker. Like the cinematic saga, the glut of Star Wars television has also been a hit-or-miss prospect for me. The animated shows felt like they had way too many barriers to entry, but the first season of The Mandalorian was genuinely exciting as a way forward. But in its wake came its unholy offspring, The Book of Boba Fett, and the unwatchable Obi-Wan Kenobi series. I have seen precisely 0 seconds of Ahsoka. And while I dug 2016's Rogue One just fine, I wasn't exactly clamoring for a series that was yet again going to slot into a time gap in the Star Wars saga that didn't need filling. But in the fall of 2022, we got Andor, centering on the early days of Diego Luna's character Cassian Andor from Rogue One. From that movie's co-writer and significant reshoot director Tony Gilroy, Andor has eschewed epic space opera fantasy in the Joseph Campbell hero's journey to tell a story of the insidious banality of fascism and what it takes to truly rise against it. And nevermore is that rise more present than in the 10th episode of its first season, One Way Out. The third in a 3-episode mini-arc in which Cassian is sent to an Imperial work prison housed in an imposing column surrounded by water on the ocean planet Narkina 5. Cassian and the floor chief of his work shift, Kino Loy, have just discovered that released prisoners are being cycled back in mere days after their release, and that an entire floor was executed once word got out about it. Kino Loy, once a man dedicated to earning his freedom through hard work for the Empire, has begun to crack.
He's only a doctor. They would never tell him.
No one is getting out!
It's true. Rumors are true. They're not letting us go. Ever. We're gonna die here. Or in the next place. So let's get our heads back in our cells and start figuring this out.
Kino Loy is played by the great Andy Serkis, a live human person. He appears here on camera with nary a sensor nor reference dot on his face or body. Despite the pioneering mocap work he's done in Lord of the Rings and Planet of the Apes, Andor teaches us that being human on camera is probably exactly where Andy Serkis belongs. Also contributing to the tactile nature of the show are the production design of and costuming within this prison set. It's not overly ostentatious, but perfectly Spartan for the type of facility it would be. It's the rare Star Wars prequel property that, from a visual standpoint, feels like a reasonable precursor to the world of the original trilogy. Ditto Nicholas Britell's great music in this episode and throughout the series. The perfect blend of Star Wars-y familiarity, but not too in your face, and still something entirely its own. The early part of the episode darts between Cassian at the prison and the various non-Cassian story arcs. Stellan Skarsgård's rebel organizer Luthen Rael gets word one of his spies in the Empire wants a meeting. Dedra Miro, a talented Imperial officer dedicated to her own advancement in the Empire, experiences a spot of misogyny in reaction to her successful ploy to draw out Luthen's insurgency, and we also get one scene with Genevieve O'Reilly's Senator Mon Mothma reprising her role from a couple of movies, where her financial support of the budding rebellion might come at an uncomfortable cost.
Let's have it.
I'd like a return invitation. I'd like to come back here, at least once.
I'm sure that's something that can be arranged.
I have a 14-year-old son. I'd like to bring him with me.
You can't be serious.
I'm not asking for betrothal.
Then what are we talking about?
An introduction. Her daughter's 13. She'll soon come of age. Two young people, attractive and privileged Chandrillan citizens.
What makes you think I approve of that tradition?
Our position sometimes makes decisions for us, don't you find, Senator? Neither of us have lived a life that encourages nonconformity.
Is that your only offer?
I'm afraid so.
Tay will see you out.
Here, Mon Mothma must ask herself what many characters in Andor ask themselves. What is the personal cost of effectively competing with an amoral entity? And where do you, should you, or can you draw the line? All these moments are still thematically resonant to the anti-fascist themes of the episode, but right around the 15-minute mark, these other storylines step aside and we spend nearly all the rest of our time with Cassian and Kino, just as they're about to spring their rebellious escape plan into action. The refrain of "One Way Out" makes its way quietly among the increasingly nervous and fatalistic prisoners, with Cassian reinforcing the notion of putting the cause before themselves.
Are we really doing this? You're still on board?
I want out. Don't care how.
I'm dead.
Hey,
I pretend to be dead. Don't die till you put up a fight.
One way out. Come on!
What follows is a deeply thrilling, tense, extended action sequence. After a hydro malfunction engineered by Cassian, a distracting scuffle between two prisoners, and a well-placed pipe to jam the elevator, the lethally electric floors go cold, and the prisoners full-on revolt against their captors. Climbing floor by floor, the rebels lose a few members along the way, but gain scores more until they reach the control room at the top. As much as Andor can be lauded for its complex, murky character dynamics and bold political take on the Star Wars universe, the first season also has no shortage of genuinely great action sequences. Each of the mini-arcs is often capped by a showdown of some kind, all of which employ uncommonly lucid spatial geography, novel uses of the environments they inhabit, and life-or-death stakes for characters we've actually been given some time to grow to care about. And One Way Out has got to be the best of them. And for as much as we're cheering for the prisoners, we can also be a little disturbed that once Cassian acquires a blaster in the melee, he's emotionless, cold, and matter-of-fact as he takes out the first few Imperial guards. He's not Luke Skywalker. He's not even Han Solo. He's seen enough to know that dashing, earnest heroism or roguish, quippy detachment isn't quite enough to take down an empire. With Diego Luna giving a blank expression as he murders his nameless oppressors, we once again ask, what do you sacrifice within yourself for the greater good? Cassian and Kino reach the control room where they finally see the true source of the prison's demonic voiceover, which absolutely made me chuckle.
This is a facility-wide emergency announcement. Complete program protocol will commence in 40 seconds. Any deviation
or failure to comply will result in unit-wide activation. Start the count.
Using their own terminology and intimidation tactics against them, they reveal that these Imperial flunkies are far more concerned with self-preservation than commitment to their cause, easily getting them to shut down the security countermeasures for the entire prison. When Cassian implores a trepidatious Kino to make a speech to the prisoners, he knows it has to be Kino who takes the mic. The face of rebellion rarely works as the hand of rebellion, something he's learned from his mentor Luthen, and here bears a nice parallel to Luthen's relationship with celebrity rebel Saw Gerrera, a role reprised from Rogue One by Forrest Whitaker in an earlier episode. Kino quickly gets it together, and we get this.
There is one way out. Right now. The building is ours. You need to run, climb, kill! We need to help each other. You see someone who's confused, someone who's lost? You get them moving and you keep them moving until we put this place behind us. There are 5,000 of us. If we can fight half as hard as we've been working, we will be home in no time. One way out! One way out!
Inspiring and chilling all at once, you'd think that monologue would be Kino Loy's most resonant moment of the episode, the culmination of his transition from sycophantic work boss to the voice of a small revolution. But alas, once the prisoners head for the exit en masse, the guards cowering in a closet, we are reminded that Narkeena V is an ocean-based planet, and Kino reveals the following.
What's wrong? What? What did he say?
Can't swim!
In an incredibly framed aerial shot, we see the prisoners swim away, and Kino's fate is never revealed. And that would have been the end of a pretty great episode. But one more scene awaits us. Turns out that Lani, the uppity Imperial officer who shut down Dedra, is actually the spy requesting a meeting with Luthen. A pretty cool reveal. In a clandestine location, Lani reveals a trap that's been set for a rebel named Krieger, a trap Luthen intends to send Krieger into for fear of revealing the presence of his mole. This was also a plot beat in the 2014 movie The Imitation Game, but the difference here is that it's less, fucking boring. Lani wants out of the spy game, and Luthen isn't having it, seeing Lani as too valuable an asset on the inside. When Lani makes things personal, claiming Luthen has made no sacrifices himself, Luthen replies,
I've given up all chance at inner peace. I made my mind a sunless space. I share my dreams with ghosts. I wake up every day to an equation I wrote 15 years ago from which there's only one conclusion. I'm damned for what I do. My anger, my ego, my unwillingness to yield, my eagerness to fight, has set me on a path from which there's no escape. I yearn to be a savior against injustice without contemplating the cost, and by the time I look down, there's no longer any ground beneath my feet. What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. Now, the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice? Everything!
A perfect distillation of the episode and the series as a whole, delivered with Shakespearean, Skarsgårdian gravitas. What more could you want? When Cassian first formulates his prison break plan, his response to the many cameras in the prison is that nobody's watching, and their ignorance to and complacency with what's going on will be what sets the prisoners free. I can't help but think that Tony Gilroy and company, including House of Cards creator Bo Willimon, this episode's credited writer, had the same nobody's-watching mentality about Disney execs when making the show. Gilroy had already proved himself a Disney company man when he came to give Rogue One the polish it needed for Disney to see it as releasable, and in Disney's trust of Gilroy going forward, he went under their noses and put out the most adult-oriented, morally viscous, downright radical thing to ever bear the Star Wars logo. In terms of viewership, we'll never really know if nobody was watching the first season because Disney doesn't have to tell us. But the show having been picked up for a 2-season run before it even entered production certainly bodes well for the quality of its future. Ultimately, the best thing I can say about One Way Out is that it actually got me excited about Star Wars at a time where I had more or less accepted that that was never going to happen again. And excited in a way that had me on the literal edge of my seat every time I've watched One Way Out. It appeals to just about every part of my pop culture brain, and I hope it at least appeals to enough of yours to induct it in. Truly, this episode belongs in the canon. No ifs and or buts.
No.
Taylor.
Get out.
Stuck the landing. Stuck the landing.
Thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. Dave and I think we're more steeped in this show. So, Sarah, why don't you go first?
Okay. I think that I had watched the first couple of these for us to talk about it.
Yes.
I remembered it with vague positivity, but also it was just one of those things where it was like, this did not grab me enough / make it up enough to me for Obi-Wan for me to continue. I like wasn't mad at it, but I just hadn't kept up with it. So I queued this up on Disney Plus, and there's the recap, and I was like, all right, and I'm watching that, and I was like, oh shit, Prison Break. And this is a fantastic episode in terms of like being an exemplar of how to shoot a Prison Break episode and suck people into the show with it who are not familiar. Like, I had a vague idea based on the little, you know, recap at the top, what I was dealing with. I live in the world and know people who watch the show, so I had a vague sense of what was happening. But the way that it was assembled, and I had just enough information to be like, oh, but then the way the episode itself was assembled and the way it executed on not just cutting back and forth occasionally to other plots off the prison base or set, but as Taylor, you pointed out in your presentation, the way that it made the layout of the prison extremely legible,
yep.
The way it had of visually underlining certain things that you were supposed to notice or sort of, you know, knowing Lincoln Center movie theater nod at was good. It created this tension that, like, because you've watched TV and movies before, you have a basic idea of how it's gonna go, but you're still very tense. And that one scene where, like, they're just waiting to see what the water does, and everybody's just sort of looking back and forth at each other, and the computer is like squawking about on program in this creepy way, and it's just like, it was incredibly tense and suspenseful and fun for that. And then you get to the lip of this jump, and the way, like, Circus's performance in that moment where it's clear that even he didn't really think it through until exactly that moment where he's like, well, fuck, I can't swim. Like, it was heartbreaking. And then there's no argument about it. You don't find out, like, a conclusion. It just is one of those, like, tragic stories in a rebellion. And then that subtext, the way it is made text at the end with Stellan Skarsgård's character and that speech that there's like 7 people acting in English who can get away with that florally Shakespearean, which I think is the term you used, monologue about the nature of the struggle and get away with it. Like, fortunately, they cast one.
Yeah.
That works out great. Good job, Andor. That I just remember I was taking notes on that point, and then I just sort of stopped taking notes because the Skarsgårdiness of it all took over. I am not a crackpot of anyone in that family. He's the one that I would with. Do not at me. I am not wrong. I did want to watch more. That's, you know, the Bunsey criterion. But I also thought that it was such a good illustration of the balance of text and subtext that you want to have in a visual property that is also driven by dialogue. And like, how do you use all the ways of telling story to tell story? So it was really cool from a, like, meta perspective to see that executed so well. But then it was, you know, there was also like an emotional reaction that it created. So great presentation, despite that little button. And yeah, this was interesting to revisit the show, but also to see it in this discreet ETE way for the canon. Cool. Tara.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get through this without crying because Dave can testify that I kind of like really lost it. This is now my third time watching this episode because Dave did a rewatch, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe, where I was sort of dipping in and out. You know, I'd seen this many times and just it struck me so much different this time. And lately, especially on Extra Extra Hot Great, we've been talking about shows where, you know, like The Regime and Manhunt that are very much trying to like take an allegorical, you know, look at our current political situation, which this, you know, does too. That's the point. But this is so much more, despite being so much more outlandish, I mean, in the sense that it's a sci-fi show that takes place in another world, it feels so much more real and visceral. And everything you're watching, like it's impossible not to get inspired by it. It's like, the juxtaposition and the, you know, the sidelines to the other storylines that Taylor mentions, like, you know, the bit with Mon Mothma and her, no offense, shitty daughter who, like, I don't care what happens to her, she's a jerk anyway. Yeah. Yes, no one should be forced into marriage, of course, whatever, but she's also a shithead, so, like, fine. That sort of pays off later in the season, but you do need a relief from the prison scenes because they're so intense. The acting is so good. Taylor, you're right about Circus, and you realize when you get to the end and the you know, closing the episode with the Luth and Lonnie scene, you realize Kino also burned his life to make a sunrise that he knew he would never see, you know, and we don't see what happens to him. We assume it's probably not great, but like this is what it takes. And it's so hard to believe a better world is possible, but you have to, or how can you go on? And so this episode is wonderful. Great choice. I got through this without crying. Thank you to Taylor's dumb dad joke at the end for saying from
to reset the equilibrium.
Yeah. Oh. I also agree. The other note that you had about the reveal of the computer voice guy just being this regular ass weedy British guy is very good too.
Totally.
So yeah, it's an exceptionally well made episode. It just works on every possible level, and the show is extraordinary. And if you never watched it because you're like, I don't care about a Star Wars and I've been burned by these shows so many times, I get it. This one really is so different, and I can't wait for it to come back. Dave.
Yeah, it is very different. Obviously, this is, I shouldn't say obviously, but for me, this is the adult Star Wars I always wanted in my head, but never really expected. But here we are, we got it. And a lot of people were kind of taken back by the pacing of it and sort of like the bold presentation of its themes, which shouldn't be a surprise because, like, even though Star Wars is like a stupid kids movie, it was anti-war and it was anti-fascist and all the things, all the good antis that we enjoyed in a part of a rich anti-diet.
Well, and in a post-Watergate landscape that colored everything, whether people creators realized it or not.
Right. But it's funny to think about the parallels between, you know, because we're saying, like, who could pull off the sunless space dialogue? Because you got that on paper. And Luthen says this at the end. You're like, Jesus Christ, this is really heavy handed. Like, this is space spear stuff, right? But he does pull it off. And then on the opposite side with like Star Wars, you got Harrison Ford saying things like, George Lucas, you know, you can write this shit, but you can't make people say it because it's so like it's so bad at writing dialogue. And it's funny to think you got like cream of the crop writer. Who's the writer of this one? I forget. He's the House of Cards guy.
The House of Cards guy. Wild.
You know, credited as the writer.
His best work for sure.
So this show is just full of great monologues. There's two of them here. There's the manifesto earlier in the season that we get. And then there's the funeral transmission in the episode two after this one, the finale one.
Oh, God.
And they all work, but they all are like, they're all like so out of their depth in as far that like that people would actually take the time in these situations to be so eloquent and so well written. That you think they're not going to work, but they all fucking work. And the sunless space place one is such a moment for me in Star Wars. Like, I was just like, oh, this is so good. and like really shines a light on something we haven't seen on Star Wars, which is like, yeah, everybody's got to get their hands dirty if this is going to work.
Yep.
Like Star Wars, the movie, is like at the end of the line. And these are the people that can storm the beach. Some of them are not going to make it, but the ones that do will be on the posters for the next 50 years. This guy and like Andor and all the people in the prison and stuff like that, you're never going to see him again. But they're the ones that set it all up. That weird juxtaposition between, you know, all these people getting their hands so dirty and like just crawling in the muck. But then like these fantastic monologues and all this great dialogue and all these like dark, realistic themes going on in this show. And it's Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like fucking hell. Just stick it up right in my veins. Mm-hmm. And then like after this was Obi-Wan Kenobi series. You're like, oh, my God, what the fuck is this shit? Yeah,
the worst.
It just made everything else that they were putting out pale by comparison. I had a really hard time getting into. I mean, Obi-Wan Kenobi sucked balls. Like, that was a terrible series. It looked terrible. It was written terribly. It was incredibly unnecessary. Like, here's a show, Andor, that is unnecessary timeline-wise. We already know what happened. We got the gist of going from Rogue One to Star Wars the movie and, you know, who did what and all that kind of stuff. So, like, you're like, why do I need to watch this? Well, they did something with it. They didn't do anything with Obi-Wan. Like, Obi-Wan was just like, and then he met Darth Vader. Like, there was, like, Darth Vader battle 1.5, I guess, we never knew about.
Yeah.
And that's, like, Star Wars is full of that. Like, usually it's relegated to, like, shit you don't give a shit about, like, books and comics and stuff like that, where it's like, Luke actually had 12 lightsabers at one time, and he used them just as party presents, but you never heard about that in movies because there's
here's
a comic.
The story of the third one that is at a museum.
I'm not even joking. Luke Skywalker apparently had a gold lightsaber in between Star Wars and Empire, or Empire and Jedi. Ugh. I forget which one it is. Uh-huh. But he had like a gold one. He's going around the galaxy doing gold lightsaber shit for months and months.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
Fight a nickel.
No.
Yeah.
Point of order.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan was first. It was in the spring of 2022. This was after. Sorry. So if, but it, to your point, and to Sarah's earlier, it was like, if Obi-Wan was so shitty, it turned people off of Andor. Like, that's Disney's big fuck up, because I can get, I can understand why people would feel, you know, Star Wars fatigue. And that's too bad, because this is, you know, miles better.
All right. Yes,
more like Obi don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Or Ahsoka, or just whatever. Yeah. You know, just,
all of them. Yeah. All of them that aren't this or The Mandalorian. It's like, you all should go to nursing school or something. Like, yeah.
Mandalorian, especially season one, was a really great adventure version of Star Wars. This was like a throwback to the Saturday morning serialness of the original movies. And I think they did a really good job with that. I had nitpicks, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it really felt like Star Wars.
Yeah.
This feels like Star Wars, but like new Star Wars. You know what I mean? Like, this felt like they did a transformative take on Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Disney first buys Lucasfilm in 2012 or whatever, there was this promise of like, we're going to get all these different corners of the Star Wars universe, things that are unexplored, and they're going to be from different creative voices. And like, it took a decade for that to actually happen after them spinning their wheels and filling in gaps that didn't need filling in.
Yep.
Mm, yep.
Yeah.
Back to Andor, I'm so in the bag for this series. I'm sorry more people dig it into it, and it does start slow because it's not a, you know, Mandalorian season one type of show. But if you haven't watched it yet, just know that it's like there's like four sets of three episodes that are like all mini arcs. The prison, there's more prison stuff. There's like a whole little chunk that's all just basically the prison stuff, and then like building up to the finale. I can't recommend it enough. It is my favorite Star Wars thing that has happened since like the original series. So I am in the bag for this. Great presentation, Taylor. I'm surprised you brought in all those live effects and musics and everything like that to do that live.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most impressive live presentations we've ever had.
Thank you.
Let's put this to the vote. Sarah DeBunting, what say you?
I say yay, for sure.
Yes.
Me too.
Woo!
All right, that means Andor, Season 1, Episode 10, One Way Out. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
I do, and I did not just choose this because of our Simpsons abstaining guest. That's just a coincidence. Cypress Hill, a band you might remember from the 1990s, have made a Simpsons prediction from their Lollapalooza knockoff episode come true. They have booked a show with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I think that is very funny. So thank you to Cypress Hill. Thank you to this orchestra, and thank you to Simpsons for predicting this all those many years ago. And if you go to the show, let us know how it is.
And loser of the week, Sarah?
There's two. One is me, because I just realized that I should have voted for the canon with yes and or.
Yeah!
Okay. Don't get up, I'll fire myself. But first, let me tell you that the other actual loser is Brian Austin Green. Megan Fox reflected recently on her, quote, unfulfilling marriage to him in a write-up on etonline.com of a podcast appearance, I believe, in which she was also reminding us that when they got together, she was 18 and he was 30, which I always kind of put out of my mind. And whenever I'm like, him? I should also remember that she was a basically child. And he sucks, man.
Yeah, he sucks.
Oh, that's it. Speaking about things that suck, do you know what time it is?
Game time.
Game time. I just want to pre-apologize for this game time because my sleep schedule has been really fucked up. No, I feel like I'm just going to do a bad job of it. That's all.
Oh, I see.
The game is good. The game is not by me. You don't have to worry about that. I slept for like 25 hours in one day somehow recently. And then the next day I slept for negative 10 hours. Mm-hmm. So I'm just all over the map. Just want people to know if game time's a little weird, that might be why. And I apologize. Okay. Or it might be the best game time ever. It won't. Okay. This is the sixth game time of the season. Our scores are, because it's been a hot minute since we've had a regulation game.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Tara has 3 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 1 point. Value guests, represented by Taylor S. Cole this week, also have 1 point. So 3-1-1. Today we're playing Nemesis from Potsy. Potsy's back. Hello, Potsy.
Potsy. Hey.
Potsy earns himself an extra credit. Topic of his choosing, plus a free shirt at the EHG store at throughmethods.com. Today's quiz will test your knowledge of TV characters and their nemeses. I will give you a TV character name, and for 3 points, you give me the name of the main character they oppose.
Okay.
If you need a hint, I can give you the TV show in question, but then the answer is only worth 1 point. You only get one guess, so make it count. So once again, I'm giving you the character.
Yep.
You have to tell me who their nemeses are. I'll be generous with the character names. Sometimes first names will be okay. If you need a hint, I'll give you the show. Here's an example. If I said Sherlock Holmes, you would say his nemesis was?
Jim Moriarty.
Moriarty, sure, yeah. From the TV show only, Sherlock. It was never a book series for the purposes of that example.
Yep.
Steel mill situation, please, Tart.
Thank you, Dave. Our steel meal situation is as follows. Sarah has 3. I have 5. Valued guest has 3 plus Eric's meal for a total of 4.
All right. So use them if you need them. Let's throw it to Pinky to see who... Nope. See, told you. Let's throw it to Pinky to see who's going first. Damn it, Pinky. I managed to be on the ball and Pinky's there like, I'm not going to do it.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Okay. So it's Tara, Taylor, Sarah is our order. Are we ready to play Nemesis?
Yes.
All right. So I'm going to start you all off with cartoon Nemesis.
Okay.
For your first question. All pretty easy. I expect a lot of 3 point answers here. Tara, Sideshow Bob Terwilliger.
His nemesis is Bart Simpson.
His nemesis is Bart Simpson. You are correct. 3 points. Taylor, Shredder.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and their master Splinter.
I think is the best answer there. Sarah D. Bunting, Megatron. Megatron.
Ooh, shit. Optimus Prime?
Optimus Prime from the Transformers is correct. Nice. Everybody has 3 points. We are done with cartoons.
Okay.
Okay.
Tara.
Yeah.
Red John.
Oh, that's the Mentalist, and he probably has a name.
Yep. Probably does. It's going to be a hard time getting points now.
Yep. I don't know what it is. So
Mentalist.
Give me the first name if you only know the first name. I'm going to be generous.
I only know the actor, which is Simon Baker.
I'm not going to give you that.
Nope.
Patrick Jane. Can't trust him. He's got two first names.
That's right.
Tell me about
it. Okay.
Back to Taylor. Vecna. V-E-C-N-A.
Hint, please.
That is from the show Stranger Things. Vecna.
11?
Yeah, 11 is correct. Good for 1 point.
Okay. Phew.
Sarah D. Bunting. Phil Leotardo.
Oh, boy. I mean, that SUV that ran over his head? Spoiler. I know it's from The Sopranos. So, I mean, Tony Soprano is his nemesis?
Tony Soprano. He was like the last season nemesis. Mm-hmm. Tara?
Yep.
Madeline Wunsch.
She is the nemesis of Raymond Holt.
Raymond Holt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Correct. 3 points. Back to Taylor. Sue Sylvester.
Will Schuster.
Yes, from Glee, correct. Back to Sarah D. Bunting, Paris Geller
is the nemesis of the Little Gilmore. Fuck.
The Little Gilmore.
No, it's not Lorelai. It's the other one.
Norovirus?
The Alexis Bledel one.
Shut
Gilmore
up.
Gilmore Jr.
Shut up, blank.
Oh, shit. Oh, what is her fucking name?
Steel Mill, anybody?
Steel Mill. Rory Gilmore.
Yes, Rory Gilmore is correct. 3 points steal. Tart.
Nice.
Yeah.
Conrad Eckley.
He's the nemesis of Gil Grissom.
Gil Grissom from Original Rays CSI. Correct. Back to Taylor. Sean. Just Sean. No last Sean. Name. Yeah.
Sean. The only Sean I can think of is Boy Meets World, and he has a last name, so yeah. I'm going to ask for the hint.
The show is The Good Place.
Oh, sure. Sean is Mark Evan Jackson, and his nemesis is Ted Danson, who plays Michael.
You are correct. Good for 1 point. This is for Sarah D. Bunny. We'll take us into our first score break. We've got Marcy Darcy. Knee Rhodes.
Marcy Darcy. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, shit. Hint.
Married with Children is the show.
I was right. Al Bundy?
Al Bundy is correct, yes. And we are one-third the way through our game. Let's hit the scores.
It's a very close game. Taylor's in the lead with 12. I have 9. Sarah D. Bunting barely behind me with 7. But
all
that
right.
Means...
it's time for the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone, Ms. Bunting. Woo! All right. What is your trivia box pleasure?
Famous original Trivial Pursuit,
Purple
please.
Box?
Yeah.
TV edition. Published somewhere in the mid-80s, we think. Here we go. Classics. What 50s Tonight Show host also composed some 4,000 songs?
Jack Parr?
Steve Allen. Sitcoms. What 1990-91 CBS sitcom was hyped... he's rude, he's crude, he's family.
He's rude, he's crude, he's family.
1991, CBS sitcom.
Alf.
Uncle Buck.
Yeah, the Kevin Meaney one.
That's right.
Drama. Whose body was left floating in the Ewing pool at the end of the 80-81 season?
JR.
Kristen. Mm. All right, you need all three of these last questions
okay.
to get points, and we forgot to talk about points, but let's say for 3 points. 3 points.
Okay.
3 and 6, but 6 is out of contention for you at this moment. All right, here we go. Kids and games. What musical instrument does Ralph the Dog play on The Muppet Show?
Ukulele?
Piano, Taylor S. Cole, piano. Pianist in the house. He knew that one. All right, so no points on the equalizer zone there, but plenty of game still to go. All right, let's get back to the game. We have a score correction first, though.
We do. I can't do math. Taylor has 11 points, not 12.
All right, so the new point structure is?
Sarah has 7. I have 9. Taylor has 11.
All right. What if I did the Grosso Equalizer Challenge Zone again just because I'm a creature of habit? All right. Back to Tara.
Yep.
Ogden Wormstrom.
His nemesis is Professor Hubert J. Farnsworth.
Yes, from Futurama. Correct. Taylor. Agatha Harkness.
That would be Wanda Maximoff.
Yes, correct. From WandaVision. Sarah. Goliath.
do you want a vehicle answer or a person answer?
Try me.
Both? Michael Knight, who drives Kit.
Yes, Kit Michael is Knight. The nemesis. What was your other answer?
Michael Knight.
No, what was your other? Oh, I see. I thought you were going to say, like, dating Goliath.
Oh. The answer is David.
Not from the Bible, but from the stop animation
from
thing.
The
somehow
TV
they hated
sure.
each
yeah.
other. Yeah, they fucking hated each other. God damn it, Davey.
Yeah, there's a little behind the music.
Don't go.
Really shocking.
Keep your eyes open when you sleep.
Yeah. See, what do we got here? We got Tara. Bob Kelso.
Oh, his nemesis is Ted the lawyer?
Do you think Ted the lawyer is his nemesis?
No, I think Dr. Kelso is Ted's nemesis.
Mm.
I guess it's not reciprocal. I don't know, Perry Cox, I guess.
Yeah, Perry Cox. I'm going to give you that one just because we know.
All right.
All right. This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
It is for Taylor. Roderick Decker. Roderick Decker. Colonel Roderick Decker. Ooh. I'm going to give you that information.
I will still take a hint.
All right. The show is the A-Team.
Oh.
Colonel Decker. Always after that A-Team.
I will say Hannibal.
Hannibal Smith is correct. 1 point.
Hey.
Alexander Mahone for Sarah D. Bunting. Alexander Mahone.
Alexander Mahone. Hint.
The show is Prison Break.
Fuck, I knew that. And Mahone is played by Fichtner.
That's
so,
right.
And his name is Michael.
Is he one of the brothers?
Yes.
Yes.
Are the brothers the Burrows? Okay, and Lincoln. Okay, Lincoln was the answer here, but I think.
Burrows.
Keep
I couldn't
it in the
pull
family,
Michael's
right?
last name for some reason.
Sure. Tara.
Yeah.
Simon the Devious.
His nemesis is. Laszlo Cravensworth.
You are correct. What We Do in the Shadows. Back to Taylor. Mm-hmm. Gus Fring.
Walter White.
Yeah, sure. Walter White. Back to Sarah. Boyd Crowder. Nice steaming bowl of Boyd Crowder.
Delicious.
With crackers.
It's the little bacon bits. That really make it. My mind has emptied of protagonist names. I could describe this man and his hat and his lack of pants to an identikit artist.
You know this name.
And yet, do I?
Yeah.
It's J.U. Stiffied. Dave Point? Anything?
That's good.
We're looking for Raylan Givens.
Oh,
Raylan Givens.
We sure were. And
all
where
right.
was he?
Tara.
Not in this office.
Yep.
Chuck Rhodes. And that's with an R and an H and all that kind of extra shit.
Hint.
The show is Billions. Maybe the S has a dollar sign in. I don't know. Never watched.
Okay. I think his nemesis is Axe? Something Axelrod? Bobby Axelrod.
There you go.
Wow.
Good for 1 point.
Nice.
Well done.
To Taylor, Anson Fullerton.
Hint.
Burn Notice is the show.
Anson Fullerton, right down Fullerton Lane.
Well, the only character's name I know from Burn Notice.
Not the yogurt.
Oh, we're just giving hints now?
Oh, sorry.
is Bruce Campbell's character, who I believe is named Sam Axe. So I'm going to say Sam Axe.
Oh, great guess. Not correct. Michael Weston, the lead character, was the nemesis there. This is for Sarah. We'll take us into our second score break and a second equalizer opportunity. Your character is Al Bester. You're never going to get this. Al Bester.
Oh, my God. Get it, Hint. Sarah.
Get it. All right. Your show is Babylon 5.
Oh, yeah, you're never going to get it.
Bab L on 5.
I don't know how you got that one, but you did. John Sheridan is your nemesis there. All right.
That guy.
We are two-thirds done.
Now he's my nemesis, too.
All right. Please, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong. I have me with 19.
Me good score. Other people bad.
I card read good. I have 19. Taylor has 18. Sarah has 11.
Yes, regrettably, that is correct.
All right, Sarah, you can get 6 more points.
Oh,
possibly
fuck.
Here. Ooh. So here we go. You are again in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Do you want to continue with the Trivia Pursuit TV Edition box, or do you want to change your...
My new nemesis? No, I don't. What is the other...
80s-ish, 90s-ish, off-brand, and the...
Can I... With 90s-ish, I get a year, right?
Yes.
Right. That one.
All right, just to place you, I am reading from the 90s Pop Culture Edition, the viewing section. Oh, look at this. I'm going to read you one from Wired. Ooh. This one has a TV question in the Wired category. It is from the year 1998. What Law and Order star sued eBay for allowing his social security number to spill into cyberspace?
I don't remember this at all. Benjamin Bratt?
Jerry Orbach.
Wow.
Oh, Orby.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
What Saved by the Bell star served as a tag team partner of a pro wrestler dubbed the Blue Meanie?
Saved by the Bell star?
Yeah. Served as a tag team partner of a pro wrestler dubbed the Blue Meanie. I have no idea if that happened outside the show or inside the show.
I don't either, but either way, it sounds like some Dustin Diamond shit, so that's my guess.
That was 1999, by the way, and you're correct.
Woo!
Ooh, 1994, Sarah. What cable hit was all about what happens when people stop being polite and start getting real?
The Real World.
The Real World is correct. You need one more. One more. You got 3 chances for it.
It's my favorite song.
While Dave is doing that, I just, along the lines of the Aaron Fullerton thing, I woke up the other day singing Intuitive Eating in my mind with the tune of Detachable Penis. So, Intuitive Eating. No one has thought about that song since the 1990s.
I was singing Aaron Fullerton to the tune of Psychotherapy by the Ramones.
Oh.
Me, Mom, and Daddy.
I like your chances here, Bunting. 1994. What Revenge of the Nerds survivor landed a starring role on
Anthony Edwards.
Edwards is correct. 3 points added to your total. Update the scores and give them to us, please, Tara. Try to use full sentences.
Okay. Sarah D. Bunting has 14 points. Taylor S. Cole has 18 points. I have 19 points.
All right, close game. Let's get back into it. Everybody has 4 questions. 12 points possible to be added to your total. Tutar.
Yep.
William Bracken.
Hint.
That show is Castle.
Castle. No, is Castle his nemesis?
Oh, I see.
Richard Castle? I think that's his name.
I think your reaction should be a clue to whether that was correct or not.
Oh, all right.
That was Kate Beckett. To Taylor, Norm Glinsky.
Hint, please.
Good luck. Your show is Private Eyes.
I will say John Oates.
I mean, yeah.
Angie Evert.
Sure.
Shut up, and.
Sarah, Nina Myers.
boop, beep. Ina Myers was the... Oh my God. What was his name? Kiefer Sutherland. I can't remember character names today. I'm having a stroke.
Boy.
That's my answer. Buzz
really?
Me.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right.
All right. Well, that's the 3 points that laid sitting out there.
Steel Mill? Jack Bauer?
Jack Bauer. Yep. Jack Bauer. Not 24. Back
that
to Tara.
Yeah.
Regina Mills.
Hint.
Once upon a time. I remember Regina Mills.
Teehee, Regina.
God. What was her name? What was her name?
I think Regina Mills is like Wicked Queen of the something.
I know who she is. I know who played her, saying, and I can picture it was, what's her name,
I'm
Morrison,
to the
who played
audience.
Her. No, it was her last name Swan?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I have to have her first name too? We're not
I
doing Jeopardy
see if you
rules?
Can get it.
Stephanie?
Yeah, sorry. It's Emma Swan.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I should give that to you.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, I'm not going to give it to you. No, but I'm meaner. Taylor, Scorpius. Yes. Scorpius.
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 Imported German beer.
I hope it's not from the show Scorpion that my mom really liked. I will take the hint, please.
Yeah. Moms love that shit.
It is not from Scorpion. It is from Farscape, which is a different show from Babylon 5.
I will say Fozzie Bear.
Close. John Crichton.
Oh, sure.
John Sarah.
Got Ghostin. Yes.
Villanelle.
Oh. Well, I know the show. And
I'm going to give you first name rights.
Yeah, her name is in the title.
Think about it.
Big head.
It's not Jack Bauer. Don't say Jack Bauer. You just embarrass yourself.
Michael Knight.
What?
I really get first name rights? Okay. Eve.
It's Killing. Her name is Killing. Killing, and then Eve is her last name. Sorry. Yes, that is correct.
I
Eve.
Counted it.
Yeah, I got it.
All right. Tara.
Yeah.
Dolores Abernathy.
Hint.
Westworld. Westworld Spritzer. Spritzer.
So that could be anyone. His name was the Man in Black, but I don't remember what his actual name was. So
yeah,
I don't know.
I think it's the same character. Dr. John Ford.
Oh, well, someone could have
I'd allow the
stole
Man in
Black. Me
Nobody's
that
gonna
one.
Get that.
Okay.
Dr. John Ford. I don't know if he's the
Ford
Man in Black.
Ford was Hopkins. John Ford with Anthony Hopkins.
Right, but that was him old, wasn't it? Wasn't he also the Ed Harris
no,
character?
No, Jimmy Simpson.
Ed Harris
oh,
also.
Was that revealed in season 3? Jimmy
I don't know.
Simpson and Ed Harris were the same character.
All right.
Jesus. It's fine.
We're going to mark that as a no.
Yeah. Okay.
Taylor. Yes. Sheriff Don Lamb. Sheriff Don Lamb.
Oh, shoot. I know this.
You do.
I know. I know what show this is. Sheriff Lamb. I'm going to say Keith Mars.
Keith Mars from Veronica Mars is
nice.
Correct.
Nice.
Everybody has... Nope.
Sarah
nope,
still has one.
Nope. 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 But Sarah's going to get 3 points here. I can feel it.
Okay.
Sarah DeBunting.
Oh, God. Thank you.
What was his name? Newman.
Jerry Seinfeld.
Wow, she got it. 3 points. All right, now everybody has one question left, so let's get the scores.
Okay, Sarah has 20. I have 19. Taylor has 24.
Wow, there's movement. 24. There's been movement.
Boop. Beep.
This is
Beep.
For Taylor. Beep.
Nope. It's for me.
Yeah, let me finish. This is friend, Tara Arrieto.
More acquaintances, but that's fine.
Wow.
Wow.
Hurtful.
All right. Tara.
Yeah.
Stan Beeman.
Philip and or Elizabeth Jennings.
Yeah, Philip Jennings is probably the best match there from the Americans. Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Butcher.
Billy No, that's Billy Butcher's son is from Hocus Pocus. So I will take the hint, please.
The show is The Boys.
Oh, that's why I don't know. I will say, who is one of the boys? I still need to see this show. I will say, Shark please. Guy.
Yeah, Shark Guy. I was going to say, please make up a superhero name, and you did. It's Shark Guy. Incorrect, but I love that answer. I'm going to give you 2 Dave points, but no real points.
Fair.
We're looking for Homelander. Apparently, his real name is John Gilman, I'm reading here. I don't think I knew that. All right, so no points there.
Shouldn't that be the Aquaman's real name? John Gilman?
Shark
Guy. Yes.
Oh, yeah, John
Great
Gilman.
Point.
Yeah, good point. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, last chance for points. Gul Dukat. Sounds like
the kind of bunkport, Gul Dukats. Hint, please.
This is Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Oh, for God's sake.
God damn it.
Sisko
is correct. 1 point.
Hey!
Now it's time for the final
scores. I knew one thing.
Very close game. Sarah finished with 21. I had 22. Taylor is our victor with 24.
Beep, boop, beep. All right, we have a tiebreaker here we'll use for future steel meals. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a burp that wants to come out, but it's not.
Oh, dear.
It might come out during this question. If it does, I'm not apologizing. All right, so shout out the nemesis whenever you think you know it. I will accept 2 different answers for this one because that's the way brains work. Moff Gideon.
Mando. Din Djarin.
Yes, those are both the answers. The Mandalorian, Din Djarin, nemesis to 1 Moff Gideon. We will put an extra steel mill in the value guess column. Woo!
Valued guest.
Valued guest.
Valued guest. Yes, well done. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We beat our discussion of Roadhouse to death before going around the dial with stops at Girls 5 Eva, Lost, Homicide New York, and Chicken Nugget. Taylor used the tools of his enemy to get Andor's one way out into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Taylor was also the winner of this week's Game Time from Potsy. Next up, it's Acting Coach Nightmare on EEHG this Friday, and come back right here, EEHG Prime next week for Parrish. Remember,
we're listening.
I'm David T. Cole, feeling like I've on cocaine.
Cocaine!
You know, on behalf of Tara Arietta.
That's my uncle.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I share my dreams with ghosts.
And Taylor S. Cole.
No one is getting out.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
No one is getting out!
Ding, ding, ding! You just won 2 more points for some reason.
Wow!
The new rule we have.
Love it when that happens.
Oh, my goodness.
It's been a while.
It's been a sec. All right. Let's stop this recording then. Well done. I do feel like I'm... Something is wrong with my heart. Westworld Spritzer!